Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of American Criminal. In our latest season, the child of Italian immigrants sets out to achieve the American dream. And if he has to spill some blood along the way, so be it. Listen to American Criminal, Al Capone, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get ad-free access to the entire season first, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
It's summer, 1801. Secretary of State James Madison sits at his desk in the State Department in Washington. Across from him, the notorious scandalmonger and political journalist James T. Callender. Secretary Madison, I have lost labor, gained thousands of personal enemies, got my name inserted in hundreds of libels, and I have nothing to show for it. The president has pardoned you, Mr. Callender. The pardon erased my conviction, but it does not make up for the time I've already served. Nor does it make up for the $200 fine I was forced to pay out of my own pocket. Under the Adams administration, Callender had written scathing critiques of John Adams, Alexander Hamilton, and the Federalist Party. After being found guilty of violating the Sedition Act, he spent 9 months in jail and paid a hefty fine. But today, he's a free man, and his axe to grind isn't with the former President John Adams, it's with newly elected President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Callender, the fine will be repaid. The president will see to that. It is not enough. You are a free man, Mr. Callender. Let that be enough. I want a position. Madison isn't surprised by this. Callender had written him about the subject weeks ago. Madison knows exactly what Callender wants, to be postmaster of Richmond. Madison also knows President Jefferson has no intention of giving Callender a job. The president is trying to build consensus, Mr. Callender. Appointing you postmaster will fan the flames with the Federalists. Well, damn the Federalists. I went to desperate lengths for the benefit of the Republicans. I served Mr. Jefferson well by attacking Adams in the press, and I was jailed for it. I will not be sacrificed as some kind of scapegoat to political decorum or as a compromise to federal feelings. You are too well known, sir, and too much maligned to be thought worthy of public trust. I'm sorry, but the president will not appoint you, sir. Callender's eyes flash red with fury. He leans in and whispers in a low, threatening voice. I learned all manner of things during my time in prison, sir, regarding Mr. Jefferson's proclivities. I have no doubt the president would prefer his secrets never see the light of day. I want my money, Mr. Secretary, and I want the postmastership. Mr. Jefferson would be wise to acquiesce. Not long after their meeting, Secretary of State James Madison wrote a letter to his friend and future president, James Monroe. Callender made his appearance here some days ago. He seems implacable toward the principal object of his complaints and not to be satisfied in any respect without an office. In the letter, there's no direct mention of Callender's threat. It's unclear whether Madison knew what Callender was insinuating, that Thomas Jefferson had an improper relationship with one of his slaves, a woman named Sally Hemings. But if Madison did not know, he was about to find out, and so was the rest of the country. During Jefferson's first term, James T. Callender would once again wield his pen like a political weapon, only this time, he wouldn't aim it at John Adams and the Federalists. He'd aim it at the leader of his own party, Thomas Jefferson. If you're a careful Wicked Game listener, you know in the credits, I mentioned my friend Professor Greg Jackson and his podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. It's a great show. But one way it can doesn't suck even more is when you listen to it without ads. You can listen to all episodes of American Election's Wicked Game, all episodes of History That Doesn't Suck, and all episodes of many more great history podcasts without interruption by subscribing at IntoHistory.com. History That Doesn't Suck is a deeply researched chronological survey of American history from a trained academic who also knows how to tell a story. Plus, in addition to ad-free listening to one of the best American history podcasts out there, you get scores of bonus episodes at IntoHistory.com. Subscribe now at IntoHistory.com. Wicked Game is sponsored by Factor. It's been a busy month for me. We launched a new podcast with another one coming soon, all while keeping six others that we work on going strong. So I'll be frank, it's been stressful and time-consuming. What could be a perfect storm of conditions to ruin my healthy eating habits? It's so easy to go grab drive-thru, right? But I didn't, because there's Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal kit. Chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door with over 35 different options every week to choose from, including keto, calorie smart, vegan, veggie, all the ways you want to eat healthy. And there's even more to enjoy with over 55 nutrition-packed add-ons that'll help make your weekly meal planning even more delicious. And I'm dead serious when I tell you they hit the spot. Not only are they tasty, but satisfying, something you don't often get in nutritious food. Plus, it's all ready in just 2 minutes. No prep, no mess. Perfect for your most busy, stressful times and all the rest, too. Head to factormeals.com/wickedgame50 and use code WICKEDGAME50 to get 50% off. That's code WICKEDGAME50 at factormeals.com/WICKEDGAME50 to get 50% off. From Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Elections Wicked Game. The election of 1800 marked the first transfer of power between political factions in U.S. history. After over a decade of Federalist dominance in American politics, a wave of Republicanism swept over the nation. The Democratic Republicans, or Republicans for short, dominated. Republicans won the presidency, the vice presidency, the House of Representatives, and the Senate. With Thomas Jefferson's ascendancy to the White House, the era of Federalist dominance was over. The Republicans were rising. To maintain his grip on power and win the election of 1804, Thomas Jefferson, the so-called man of the people, survived brutal attacks in the press, ideological pushback from his own party, and a violent scandal that plagued his administration. This is Episode 5, 1804, The People's President. It's New Year's Day, 1802. The president stands in the doorway of the White House, surrounded by his cabinet, various diplomats, and a who's who of Washington. A small crowd gathers outside to watch the president receive a group of well-wishers. At the head of the pack, Reverend John Leland.
Mr. President, thank you for the honor of this audience.
The honor is mine, Reverend.
We have traveled hundreds of miles to be here today to deliver to you this precious cargo.
The pastor gestures to a massive horse-drawn wagon beside him, the rear covered with a tarp.
On behalf of the good people of Cheshire, Massachusetts, please accept this gift as a token of our appreciation.
Leland pulls back the tarp, revealing Jefferson's gift. Jefferson can hardly believe his eyes. In the back of the wagon sits a gigantic wheel of cheese, 4 feet wide, 18 inches thick, over 1,200 pounds.
Sir, I present the greatest cheese in America for the greatest man in America.
The pastor reads a prepared statement.
Mr. President, we live remote from the seat of the national government, yet we humbly claim the right of judging the government for ourselves. For several years past, our apprehension has been that the administration bordered upon monarchy. But we console ourselves that the supreme ruler of the universe has raised up a Jefferson for this critical day to defend republicanism and battle all the arts of aristocracy.
Jefferson steps forward to address the crowd. He reads a statement of his own.
I concur with you in the sentiments expressed in your kind address on behalf of the inhabitants of the town of Cheshire. Nothing ensures the duration of this fair fabric of government so effectively as the due sense entertained by this body of our citizens, of the value of these principles and their care to preserve them.
Just then, the White House steward steps forward and whispers in Jefferson's ear.
Mr. President, what should we do with the cheese wheel, sir?
What else?
Cut it.
Thomas Jefferson had a policy of not accepting gifts during his presidency, and so he paid the people of Cheshire $200 for the mammoth cheese, as it would come to be known in the papers. The cheese had been made in July of 1801 by the women of Cheshire. Every single cow in the Cheshire city limits had contributed milk, nearly 1,000 cows in all. A local engineer had built a massive hoop for mixing. The ladies of Cheshire had worked 11 days straight to press it. After Reverend Leland blessed the cheese, The wheel had traveled over 300 miles by sled, boat, and wagon from Massachusetts to the nation's capital. But the mammoth cheese was more than a gift. It was a political statement. The cheese wheel was stamped with a special message. Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. In the early 1800s, in the eyes of many Americans, like the people of Cheshire, President John Adams was the personification of tyranny. For rural America, Jefferson's presidency meant the era of monarchy was finally over. The era of liberty and freedom had arrived at last. At his inauguration in March of 1801, Jefferson had called for an end to partisanship. Jefferson hoped America's two political factions would come together under the banner of national unity. And in the first 100 days of his presidency, Jefferson had done his best to see that dream come to fruition. Though his cabinet was comprised entirely of Republicans, Jefferson had resisted suggestions that he remove all Federalists from their appointed positions. He had stayed away from toxic political appointees, perceived partisans like the political writer James T. Callender, choosing instead to appoint more moderate officials. And instead of focusing on partisan gamesmanship, Jefferson went to work for the people. At the outset of his presidency, the national debt was crippling, over $80 million. In his first 100 days, Jefferson responded by reducing taxes like the much-detested Federalist-inspired whiskey tax, closing or reducing the size of many government offices, and shrinking the Navy. In response, his popularity soared. But despite his success, Jefferson would also learn a hard lesson during his first term. In American politics, building consensus and striving for unity often comes at a personal price. By the start of 1802, James T. Callender was an embittered man. As thanks for his years of work on behalf of Jefferson and the Republicans, Callender wanted something in return, postmaster of Richmond. When Jefferson denied him, Callender sought revenge. In February of 1802, Callender went to work for a newspaper called the Richmond Recorder as a joint editor. In one of his earliest writings, Callender took on a defiant tone. "We shall neither calumniate nor flatter men in office. We shall neither defame nor worship men that are out of it. The public shall see that from whatever quarter imposture and falsehood may come, it shall be our ambition to blast them with the lightning of truth. We have no personal obligations to any party, although we are willing, if necessary, to contend occasionally for political principles." There is no doubt where Callender planned to aim his lightning rod of truth: Thomas Jefferson and the Republicans. In the fall of 1802, Callender wrote, "If we seem to bear hardest upon the men at present in office, it is only because they are at this time more formidable and dangerous than their defeated adversaries." Callender excoriated Republicans in print on a weekly basis, and the impact of his work reached far beyond Richmond, as his essays began to be reprinted in newspapers all across the country. Once he had the national audience he desired, Callender then focused his ire directly on Thomas Jefferson. First, he lambasted the Federalist press for not sufficiently attacking Jefferson. One Federalist editor responded directly to Callender's slight, "The fact is that there is not one recorded or unrecorded truth which can in the smallest degree militate against the integrity or talents, the patriotism or wisdom of Mr. Jefferson." But Callender begged to differ. He had been thrown in jail for writing a political pamphlet called "The Prospect Before Us," an attack on President John Adams. The pamphlet had violated the Sedition Act and had been widely seen as libelous. Callender responded to the Federalist editor by accusing Jefferson of financing his work on "The Prospect Before Us." Callender wrote that the money Jefferson paid him, nearly $4,000 in today's currency, attests beyond 1,000 letters of compliment how seriously the president was satisfied with the contents of the book and how anxiously he felt himself interested in its success. Callender backed up his claim with proof, first by quoting letters he had received from Jefferson, and then ultimately by releasing the letters in their entirety to the public. Callender wrote, "If there was guilt in the contents of the prospect, then every Republican in Virginia is a criminal, and Mr. Jefferson is by far the worst of them." Callender had proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that Jefferson was the financier of his libel, and he was just getting started. In the fall of 1802, Callender would drop the biggest bomb of all. In the September 1st edition of the Recorder, Callender wrote, "It is well known that the man whom it delighteth the people to honor
keeps, and for many years past has kept as his concubine, one of his own slaves. Her name is Sally. The name of her eldest son is Tom. His features are said to bear a striking, although sable, resemblance to those of the president himself. The boy is 10 or 12 years of age. His mother went to France in the same vessel with Mr. Jefferson and his two daughters. The delicacy of this arrangement must strike every person of common sensibilities. What a sublime pattern for an American ambassador to place before the eyes of two young ladies. By this wench Sally, our president has had several children. The African Venus is said to officiate as housekeeper at Monticello. Unlike his accusation that Jefferson paid him for his political writings, Callender did little in the way of offering proof of the Sally Hemings affair. Still, the veracity of his accusation has been largely verified. DNA evidence has now proven Jefferson did father Sally's children. But there is no consensus among modern historians about whether the relationship was consensual. Callender didn't stop with Sally Hemings. He accused Jefferson of having an affair with the wife of his neighbor and of using depreciated currency to pay off debts during the Revolutionary War. Many prominent politicians accepted Callender's Sally Hemings accusations as truth, including former President John Adams and his son, future President John Quincy Adams. But despite their ubiquity, Callender's attacks in the Recorder had no immediate impact on the political landscape of the country. In the congressional election of 1802, the Republicans maintained control over both the House and the Senate, and Thomas Jefferson stayed above the fray and never publicly commented on Callender's attacks. He stuck to the principle that the best way to win re-election was to provide results for the American people. And so, 2 years into his presidency, Thomas Jefferson wasn't focused on defending himself in the press. He was focused on getting a deal done with France for a massive territorial expansion, a deal that would come to be known as the Louisiana Purchase. Throughout the second part of the 18th century, the massive Louisiana Territory had been a pawn on the chessboard of European politics. The territory had traded hands multiple times between France and Spain. But for the U.S., the importance of the Louisiana Territory was primarily about trade. A treaty with Spain, signed back in 1795, had given the U.S. the right of deposit at the port of New Orleans. This had allowed Americans to freely transport goods out of New Orleans and had given them the right to navigate the entire Mississippi River, a necessity for trade with the Western territories. To Jefferson, New Orleans was essential. Early in 1802, he wrote, "There is on the globe one single spot, the possessor of which is our natural and habitual enemy. It is New Orleans, through which the produce of 3/8 of our territory must pass to market." But in 1800, Spain had ceded the Louisiana Territory back to France in a secret treaty with Napoleon Bonaparte. A year later, Napoleon had sent a military force to the Americas to secure New Orleans. Federalists had called for open hostilities against France, but Jefferson had urged a policy of diplomacy backed by strength. In the spring of 1802, he had penned a letter to U.S. Minister Robert Livingston, whom he had dispatched to France a year earlier. The cession of Louisiana and the Floridas by Spain to France works most sorely on the U.S. "The day that France takes possession of New Orleans fixes the sentence. From that moment, we must marry ourselves to the British fleet and nation. We must turn all our attentions to a maritime force, for which our resources place us on very high ground. And having formed and cemented together a power which may render reinforcement of her settlements here impossible to France, make their first cannon which shall be fired in Europe the signal for tearing up any settlement she may have made. This is not a state of things we seek or desire. It is one which this measure, if adopted by France, forces on us." In his message to Livingston and in his posture towards France, Thomas Jefferson was crystal clear. If France tried to block U.S. interests in New Orleans, U.S. would answer with military might. Wiki Game is sponsored by NetSuite. Here's some quick and easy math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more profit you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more these days. So to reduce costs and the headaches associated with them, switch to NetSuite, the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. And with NetSuite, you'll also reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud, no hardware required, and accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because now you've got one unified business management suite. And you improve efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math for yourself. See how you'll profit with NetSuite this year. Now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/elections. That's netsuite.com/elections. netsuite.com/elections.
On Valentine's Day 1929, a group of gangsters was massacred in a cold Chicago garage. The crime shook the country, and even though investigators had only just started looking for answers, everyone was sure they already knew who was behind the crime. Al Capone. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, a child of Italian immigrants sets out to make good on the promises of that dream. But Al Capone's path to success doesn't take him down the straight and narrow. Instead, he transforms himself from a smarter-than-your-average thug into the most infamous criminal America has ever known. Listen to American Criminal Al Capone wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
It's April 11th, 1803. Robert Livingston, the U.S. minister to France, knocks on the door to the French Minister of Foreign Affairs office in Paris, France.
Bonjour, Mr. Livingston.
Bonjour, Minister Talleyrand.
Have a seat, please.
When is Mr. Monroe due to arrive in Paris?
He arrived at the port of Le Havre a week ago. He'll arrive in Paris any moment now.
Are you looking forward to the company?
Yes, of course.
It's a lie. For months on end, Livingston has been trying desperately to achieve Jefferson's goal of securing New Orleans and the Floridas for the U.S., but he doesn't have the information he needs, mainly how much Jefferson is willing to pay for the land in question. And after months of almost no communication from Washington, when he finally did receive official word, he learned that James Monroe, a man 15 years his junior, was en route to France to act as his superior in the negotiations.
And what is Mr. Monroe's official title?
Special envoy to France.
That's a new one.
Yes, it is. What can I do for you, Minister?
Tell me, would you Americans wish to have the whole of Louisiana?
Livingston struggles to find the right response. He had never contemplated taking the entire Louisiana territory before. No one had, certainly not President Jefferson.
Our wishes extend only to New Orleans and the Floridas.
Yes, but I should like to know what you would give for the whole.
Livingston is gobsmacked. He doesn't have an answer, so he improvises.
15 million. Oh, understand, Mr. Livingston, I do not speak to you from a place of authority. The idea merely struck me.
It is certainly an interesting proposition.
Yes, think it over, Mr. Livingston, and do keep this conversation between us.
Of course, Minister. Thank you for your time.
After Livingston left Talleyrand's office, his wheels immediately started turning. If he could secure a guaranteed from Talleyrand that France would sell the U.S. the whole of Louisiana, he would be the hero, not James Monroe. So the next day, Livingston sat down at his desk, took out pen and paper, and wrote a note to Talleyrand asking him to write something in the form of a letter on your part, in generous terms. You could express the friendship of the first consul for the United States, his desire to give them striking indication of it in ceding the whole of Louisiana. We could work together to mature the treaty, even before the formal reception of Mr. Monroe. Livingston added one last bit of information. Please, sir, regard this as unofficial. President Jefferson had sent Minister Livingston and James Monroe to France to secure the port of New Orleans, authorizing them to pay $10 million for it. The American diplomats were shocked to learn that Napoleon would part ways with the entire Louisiana territory for as little as $15 million. Because Napoleon needed money to fund his ongoing global war of conquest against Great Britain, and holding on to the territory might draw France into open war with America. Releasing the territory was also a thorn in Britain's side. Napoleon would later say, "This accession of territory affirms forever the power of the United States, and I have given England a maritime rival who sooner or later will humble her pride." Napoleon was right. Less than a decade later, his prediction of war between America and France would come true. Initially, Jefferson had reservations about the Louisiana Purchase. He was worried that a U.S. president did not have the constitutional authority to make such a deal. If he moved forward without the consent of Congress, he feared that he would be setting a dangerous political precedent. Worse, he might be seen as a traitor to his own convictions, a hypocrite who abused states' rights and ruled like a tyrant. But in the end, despite these reservations, President Jefferson made the deal. Thomas Jefferson was a man of many contradictions. The author of the Declaration of Independence, the man who wrote the famous words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal," was also a slave owner, like George Washington before him. The Jefferson who called for an end to partisanship was also the same politician who had paid James T. Callender to attack his political enemies in the press. The champion of Republican principles who had spent his career deriding the Federalists for their constitutional abuses of federal power over the states abandoned those very principles to secure the Louisiana Purchase. But for Jefferson, the good outweighed the bad. He was desperately trying to avoid war with France. Securing the Louisiana Territory would stave off that war, keep France off U.S. soil, and help ignite the U.S. economy. The Louisiana Purchase was the largest territorial gain in U.S. history, doubling the size of the country. The territory stretched east to west from the Mississippi River to the Rocky Mountains, and from Rupert's Land in the north to the Gulf of Mexico in the south. It encompassed what would become 15 different states. But in spite of the massive achievement, domestic opposition to the purchase was immense. Federalists derided Jefferson, preferring stronger relations with the British over cozying up to Napoleon and the French. Members of both parties questioned Jefferson's ideological consistency. Many argued that if Alexander Hamilton had attempted the Louisiana Purchase, Jefferson and his Secretary of State, James Madison, would surely have opposed it. Jefferson himself knew the optics weren't good. In August of 1803, he wrote to James Madison, "I infer that the less we say about constitutional difficulties respecting Louisiana, the better." Jefferson maintained that the Constitution did give him the power to negotiate treaties, and as such, to secure the purchase. Members of Congress from both parties disagreed. The House of Representatives called a vote to deny the request for the purchase, but it failed by a margin of 2 votes. So on December 20, 1803, France formally ceded the Louisiana Territory to the United States for $15 million. Jefferson's decision to purchase the territory was controversial in Washington, but it would significantly help his chances for re-election. Because under Jefferson, the economy was turning around, thanks in large part to tax cuts, and the Louisiana Purchase would push the needle even further. And in the upcoming election of 1804, Jefferson and the Republicans would have the help of yet still another controversial subject, an amendment to the United States Constitution. In the first two presidential elections, George Washington had been elected unanimously. Washington's nationwide popularity had masked some fundamental problems with the electoral system outlined in the Constitution, now known as the Electoral College. Under Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, each state's legislature selected their own method of choosing electors. The number of electors per state was equal to the size of each state's congressional delegation, meaning the number of House members plus 2 for each of their senators. Each elector would vote independently for 2 men. Including one candidate who was not from the elector's home state. Electors did not vote separately for president and vice president. Political parties were not contemplated at all. After the votes were counted by Congress, if a clear majority existed, the top 2 candidates would be president and vice president. If not, the decision would be left to Congress to choose a president from the top 5 candidates. This system was riddled with flaws. In the election of 1796, Federalist John Adams had received the majority of electoral votes and won the presidency. However, the Federalist electors had scattered their second votes, resulting in Republican Thomas Jefferson getting the second highest number. As a result, the president and vice president had been elected from opposing political factions. The election of 1800 had produced an even more troubling result. Republican presidential candidate Thomas Jefferson had received the exact same number of electoral votes as Republican vice presidential candidate Aaron Burr. Jefferson ultimately won the contingent election in Congress, but Aaron Burr, who was intended to be vice president, had nearly walked away with the presidency. After this election of 1800, Republicans sought to remedy the founders' flawed system and to diminish the Federalists' impact in the election of 1804 by proposing the 12th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. In its final form, the 12th Amendment would require separate votes for president and vice president. Whoever had the most votes for each office would win. If no majority existed for president, the House of Representatives would choose from the three persons having the highest number of votes. If no majority existed for vice president, then the Senate would choose the vice president from the top two vote-getters. The 12th Amendment would also provide that electors could not vote for a president and vice president from the same state, and it specified that the constitutional rules governing who was eligible for president would also apply to the vice president. Throughout the fall of 1803, the 12th Amendment was the subject of a fierce debate in Congress. Republicans saw the amendment as a constitutional necessity, a much-needed upgrade to the broken and flawed system set by the founders. But there was a political consideration as well. Passing the 12th Amendment would likely crush the Federalists' hopes of having a legitimate impact in the election of 1804. So, of course, the Federalists argued against the amendment. In their minds, the Constitution was a compromise designed to check the influence of the larger states over the smaller ones. Federalists believed that the original electoral system was set up precisely so that smaller states had a chance to elect the vice president who might serve as a check to the president. In their minds, separating votes for president and vice president further entrenched the two-party system. These Federalists fought to retain the original electoral process, arguing that the framer system had not been given a fair chance. And so as winter approached, time was of the essence for Republicans. Any change to the Constitution required ratification by 3/4 of the states. If Congress didn't pass the amendment by the end of the 1803 winter session, the amendment might not be ratified in time for the election of 1804. But Republicans had clear majorities in both houses, giving the Federalists little option but to try to run out the clock by making one last stand on the floor of the Senate. On December 2, 1803, Federalists tried to wear down the Republican senators in a marathon debate that lasted from early morning to 10 o'clock at night. But despite the Federalists' best efforts, Republican senators had a 24-9 majority. So in December of 1803, the 12th Amendment passed. It would be ratified 6 months later. With the passage of the 12th Amendment, Jefferson's path to re-election was clear. He wouldn't have to worry about an electoral tie or another divisive contingent election in the House. But in the run-up to the 1804 election, there was still one major challenge Jefferson would have to confront, his vice president, Aaron Burr. Burr was known for having a hot temper. In 1804, that temper drove him to commit one of the most infamous acts of political violence in American history, a scandalous crime that would derail his political career, damage his relationship with Thomas Jefferson, and end the life of one of America's most influential founding fathers.
Tired of ads and promos like these? Want to skip ahead to newer elections? You can listen to all episodes of American Elections Wiki Game without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com. But not only that, you also get access to over a dozen more incredible history podcasts, also all ad-free. That includes the American Revolution podcast, a deep and thorough investigation of the times, people, and politics behind America's fight for independence. Also, the battles, because we can't start a new American nation without guns. And the American Revolution podcast tells the story of the revolution from beginning to end, from its origins in the French and Indian War, through the war itself, and on to the founding of the United States. Get American Elections Wicked Game, the American Revolutions podcast, and many others ad-free with bonus content at intohistory.com. Subscribe now at intohistory.com.
How do you solve a crime in reverse when you believe that someone was murdered but have no clue who the victim was?
We have to do our job, and we have to find out who did they kill? If it's possible, how are we going to do that?
I'm Jake Halpern, and this is Deep Cover, The Nameless Man. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The events that led to Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr's infamous duel in July of 1804
were years in the making. But it was perhaps the events surrounding the election of 1800 that had sealed Hamilton's fate. While that election of 1800 was being decided in the House of Representatives, Hamilton had successfully campaigned to prevent Burr from becoming president. In the years that followed, Vice President Burr had become increasingly estranged from President Jefferson, in large part because of his conduct during the contingent election in the House. After the electoral tie, Burr had not gracefully stepped aside. He had indeed made a play for the presidency. His plans had failed, and his relationship with Jefferson had suffered. Sensing that he might be replaced as vice president in the election of 1804, Burr switched parties and tried to run for governor of New York as a Federalist. Once again, Hamilton had stood in his way and wielded his considerable influence against Burr. Burr, who ultimately ran for governor as an independent, suffered a humiliating defeat. In June of 1804, Burr read in the papers that Hamilton had called him a dangerous man at a private dinner party during the governor's race. For Burr, it was the last straw. The two men exchanged a series of letters. Burr demanded Hamilton retract his statement and admit to the wrong he had done him. Hamilton refused and stood by his words and actions. In response, Burr demanded satisfaction. It's July 10, 1804, at 54 Cedar Street in Manhattan. Former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton sits at his desk working by candlelight. The sun is set. The dark streets outside his window are eerily quiet. As his pen strokes across the page, he reads his words aloud in a faint whisper. "This letter, my very dear Eliza, will not be delivered to you unless I shall first have terminated my earthly career." His wife Eliza is out of town, staying at their country home. If things tomorrow go poorly, this letter may be his only chance to say goodbye. "With my last idea, I shall cherish the sweet hope of meeting you in a better world. Adieu, best of wives and best of women. Embrace all my darling children for me. Ever yours, A.H. Hamilton walks downstairs. He stops at a bedroom on the first floor and peers through a crack in the door. Inside, he sees a young boy, an orphan who's been living with his family for some time, reading a book by candlelight. "May I come in?"
"Yes, sir."
"Oh, keep reading. I don't wish to interrupt you."
"Oh, I'm finished. Will you see me to sleep, sir?"
"You must say your prayers first." The boy climbs in Hamilton's lap. Hamilton takes the boy's hand in his. He gently places his other hand on top of the boy's head. "You know your prayers, don't you?" "Well, yes, sir." "Well, go on then. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come." As Hamilton listens to the boy's prayer, he can't help but reflect on his own humble beginnings as an orphan. Seeing the boy, it's almost like looking at a mirror into his past. "For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Amen." The boy drifts off to sleep in Hamilton's arms. At 3 a.m, Hamilton sits down at his desk and writes a hymn to his wife Eliza before himself drifting off to sleep. The next morning, there's a knock at his door. Two men stand waiting, Dr. David Hossack and his second, Nathaniel Pendleton. Together, the three men leave under the cover of early morning darkness. They climb onto a small boat and row across the Hudson towards the banks of Weehawken, New Jersey, where Hamilton's longtime political nemesis, Aaron Burr, will be waiting. It is difficult to fathom that the Vice President of the United States shot and killed a former Treasury Secretary in a duel. The question of what transpired on that fateful morning, who fired first, and who had violent intentions, has been the subject of centuries-long debate. But here are the facts. On Wednesday, July 11, 1804, at 7 a.m., Hamilton and Burr stood back-to-back on a cliff overlooking the Hudson River. In the presence of their seconds, both men walked their paces and fired their pistols. Intentional or not, Hamilton missed. Burr's aim was true. The next day, at 2 p.m., Hamilton died from the gunshot wound. The duel made Vice President Burr a fugitive from justice and put a swift end to his political career. He was never tried for Hamilton's death, although he would be charged with murder in both New York and New Jersey, though the charges would eventually be dropped. He would finish out his duties as vice president, continuing to serve as the president of the Senate.
But Burr would not go on to political fame and fortune. He would help plan a failed invasion of Mexico in an attempt to establish an independent government there. Allegedly, he would also be involved in a plot to encourage the West to secede from America. And in 1807, he would be tried for treason and eventually acquitted under a cloud of suspicion. But it was the duel that marked the end of Aaron Burr's career. The death of Alexander Hamilton left the Federalists without a leader. In his absence, their efforts to unseat Thomas Jefferson in 1804 failed miserably. The Federalists did not even hold a nominating caucus. Federalist leaders in Congress picked a ticket. Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina for president, Senator Rufus King of New York for vice president. The Republicans were far more coordinated. In the 1800 contest, fearing public backlash, Republicans had met in a closed-door caucus to secretly pick their candidates. But in 1804, they did it out in the open. Republicans held a nationwide caucus and gave the people a voice in the process. They renominated Thomas Jefferson for president and jettisoned Aaron Burr, replacing him with New York Governor George Clinton. In keeping with the precedent set by Washington, Jefferson and Pinckney did not openly campaign. But both sides used their party machinery and the press to launch grassroots campaigns and personal attacks. Federalists denounced the Louisiana Purchase as unconstitutional. They criticized Jefferson for being a pro-France elitist. They even rehashed James C. Callender's accusation that Jefferson was having an affair with his slave, Sally Hemings, and that he had borne her children. One particular story, titled A Philosophic Cock, depicts Jefferson's head on the body of a rooster advancing on Sally Hemings, her head on a hen. Despite the full frontal assault on Jefferson's integrity, the Federalist efforts, though, would not be enough. Jefferson's popularity and his campaign was riding the wave of a successful first term. His popularity was bolstered by the Louisiana Purchase, lower taxes, and an improving economy. Jefferson had also dramatically reduced the national debt. Through exercising his power of pardon, he had also undone the damage of unpopular Federalist policies like the Alien and Sedition Acts. The 1804 presidential election was held from Friday, November 2nd through Wednesday, December 5th. Jefferson won in an electoral landslide, capturing all but two states and over 90% of the vote. Jefferson dominated in the Federalist stronghold of New England, winning Maryland, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island, a first for a Republican candidate. In Congress, Jefferson's party also maintained a majority in the House and the Senate. But even before the start of his second term, retirement was already on Jefferson's mind. In January of 1805, Jefferson wrote, "The service for 8 years, with the power to remove at the end of the first four, comes nearly to my principle as corrected by experience, and it is adherence to that I determined to withdraw at the end of my second term. General Washington set the example of voluntary retirement after 8 years. I shall follow it." But there was something else on Jefferson's mind: the political implications of his landslide victory. In February of 1805, he wrote to a friend overseas, "The two parties which prevailed with so much violence when you were here are almost wholly melted into one." The death of Alexander Hamilton left the Federalist Party rudderless, bereft of its leader and its identity. In the election of 1808, they would hardly put up a fight. The real contest would be over the identity of the Republican Party. Jefferson would support Secretary of State James Madison as his heir apparent, but not everyone in the party would agree. In the 1808 contest, Madison and Jefferson would go to war, not with the Federalists, but with a new faction forming from inside their own party, the Tertium Quids, a Latin phrase meaning a third option. This is episode 5 of American Elections Wicked Game, 1804, the People's President. On the next episode, the election of 1808. With Jefferson out of the race, Madison looks to take his place. But to win, Madison will have to beat back mounting opposition in his own party, the first third-party movement in American history. Did you know you can skip ads and promos like these and listen to all episodes of American Elections Wicked Game without interruption by subscribing at IntoHistory.com? And not only will you be getting the whole series ad-free and bingeable, but you also get access to over a dozen more incredible history podcasts, also ad-free, like Her Half of History, Because even though Hillary Clinton may not have made history when she ran for president in 2016, there have always been women who seized power, spied for their country, created artistic masterpieces, even escaped slavery. Her half of history is perfect for all those who sat in history class and wondered, what were the women doing all this time? Because the answer is a lot. Get Her Half of History, Wicked Game, and many others ad-free at IntoHistory.com. Subscribe now at IntoHistory.com. This episode contains reenactments and dramatized details, and while in most cases we can't know exactly what was said, all our dramatizations are based on historical research. American Election's Wicked Game is an Airship production, hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. Co-executive produced by Stephen Walters in association with Ritual Productions. Written and researched by Stephen Walters. Fact-checking by Greg Jackson and CL Salazar from the podcast History That Doesn't Suck.